welcome to British Eugenics. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and my co-host is Max Musson from Western Spring. This is episode one, where we will be discussing the origins of eugenics ideas, what the term itself means, and some early examples of eugenics from our history. Matt, shall we move into this new presentation that we've got here, Eugenics in Britain?
Yes, let's do that.
Yes, let's talk about this. And this was actually suggested by you, Max, wasn't it? And we're sort of running a little bit low on Greatest Britons. We've done about 50 now, and I'm sure there are others that we could do. But it's difficult to find ones that we think listeners are going to be particularly interested in. So we thought we might have a look at things that made Britain great. We might have a look at shipbuilding, maybe have a look at the steel industry. And one thing that you brought up, Max, was the eugenics, which was basically a British idea. And Britain had a lot of influence on the early eugenics movement. Of course, we've talked about Sir Francis Galton before, who was really the father of eugenics, and he comes up in this little presentation that we've got for you here, and basically how important it was to Britain. And this is a subject that you're particularly interested in, Max, isn't it? Eugenics.
Well, when I first became a nationalist, I started to read widely the works of people who have tended to be panned in the general mass media as being old-fashioned and beyond the pale, because that's the way that the media tries to portray nationalism. And one of the things that I found there is that there are lots of people who lived during the late 1800s, the early 1900s, there was a whole body of people there who were people who could be described as polymaths, who have got immense intellects, and who were able to study a wide range of different scientific subjects, and who were the leading lights in a wide range of different scientific endeavors, and who all tended to have a belief in eugenics, in the principles of improving the stock of the nation. There's a great deal of emphasis nowadays within politics of providing training for people, but training only benefits the generation that's being trained. Training that's invested nowadays, once that generation that's been trained grows old and retires or dies, then the training that they've been given no longer has any further effect in terms of improving the position of the nation. Whereas if you can improve the quality, the average quality of people within a country, by encouraging those people who are gifted people, whether it's in the field of academia, whether it's in other fields, in the arts or in science or in sport or something of that sort, if you can improve the average quality of a nation, then that is an improvement which carries on into the next generation and into the generations that follow. And so you are building the potential of your nation. You're building the influence and the strength and the knowledge base of your nation progressively, step by step, and each step is a step forward instead of there being one step forward and one step back, as is the case if you just restrict yourself to training the current generation instead of improving the stock of the current generation, so that the stock of and the abilities of future generations is also improved.
So you're talking about quality as well as quantity there. So the quality keeps improving, and then it's got a capacity for more. More quantity, and this would benefit all peoples. This isn't something that's just going to benefit white people. I mean, it's every group would benefit from encouraging those who are most capable to breed and encouraging those who are least capable not to breed. If you're talking about heritable characteristics, because a lot of the characteristics that we have are inheritable. And that's pretty much what these scientists discovered. So let's start with a eugenics overview. And I'm getting these notes. Some of them come from Wikipedia and some of them come from English Heritage. English Heritage has come under a lot of criticism recently for some of the people that it has its blue plaques for. And the blue plaques are outside famous people's houses, and they tell you a little bit about why the person is famous. And of course, a lot of the people from the 1900s were famous for scientific reasons, which today would get classed as scientific racism. They claim that eugenics is scientific racism. So English Heritage came out with an article just discussing basically eugenics, and it's actually quite good. So I've used that for some of the notes here, and I've also used Wikipedia's page on eugenics. So we'll start with an overview. Eugenics comes from ancient Greek. The EU part stands for good and well, and the genics part comes from genes, which means to come into being or growing. So it means good growth, coming into being with all that you need, basically. Like your EU is good, or it's even better than good. And obviously the opposite of that is dys, D-Y-S. So you end up with euphoria, dysphoria, eugenics, dysgenics. Dysgenics would be encouraging the least capable people to breed, and eugenics is encouraging the most capable people to breed. So it's a set of beliefs and practices that aim to improve the genetic quality of a human population. Historically, eugenicists have attempted to alter human gene pools by excluding people and groups judged to be inferior, or by promoting those judged to be superior. In recent years, the term has seen a revival in bioethical discussions on the usage of new technologies such as CRISPR and genetic screening, with a heated debate on whether these technologies should be called eugenics or not. And as far as I'm aware, the CRISPR technology is able to actually change the genes of a living being. So it's not being done before somebody is born. It's not selective breeding. It's actually changing the biology once a creature is born. It was the CRISPR technology that was used in the COVID vaccines. And genetic screening, I mean, why would anybody complain about genetic screening? Surely it's a good idea to screen people to see whether, if they're going to have a child, whether that child is going to have a genetic disease or genetic problems. I mean, rather than thinking, well, you're talking about ending the life of somebody, you should be thinking, well, instead of that life being born into a body that doesn't function, that life is going to be born into a body that does function, that has all the resources that it needs in order to succeed. Because you end up with people saying that it's wrong to prevent Down syndrome children from being born. So there's a couple of things that are happening today that are being linked with it. And as it says here, attempting to alter human gene pools by excluding people and groups judged to be inferior. Well, is it that they're judged to be inferior? I mean, the sort of people that they wanted to not to breed were people who are alcoholics, whose alcoholism runs through the family, people who were criminals, because criminality runs through the family, people who had genetic diseases. Obviously, you don't want to be passing genetic diseases on. And yet today we say, well, this is wrong to be preventing these people from breeding. But I think all they did back then was encourage them not to breed. I don't think they went out there and sterilized people that they didn't think should breed. They explained to them why they shouldn't breed, and they gave rewards to the people that were going to have good children. By that I mean highly intelligent and highly capable children. Any thoughts, Max?
Well, I think where the eugenics movement has gone wrong in the past is that they've tended to use the wrong language. And I think this stems from the fact that the people who formed this core group of polymaths that existed during the late 1900s and the late 1800s, the early 1900s, because there were no hate speech laws in those days, because there was no political correctness, people just spoke frankly, and they spoke using terminology that just occurred to them without without any sort of fear or guard against misinterpretation by people who might deliberately want to misinterpret what they're saying in order to prevent eugenics from being implemented. And the using terms like inferior and superior are that's the wrong way to go, because that then enables people who are opposed to eugenics to classify eugenics together with all of the worst aspects of Nazism and Untermenschen and Übermenschen. It sort of fits in with that sort of thing. And I think what we ought to be talking about instead are characteristics, human characteristics that are desirable and human characteristics that are less desirable. And we can all accept that some human characteristics are desirable and some are less desirable. So intelligence is a desirable human characteristic, as is good humor, as is creativity. And the less desirable human characteristics are ignorance lack of intelligence. Lack of skill and dexterity would be a less desirable characteristic. If somebody was clumsy, that would be less desirable. And the point is that the eugenics should be spoken about, and it tends to be spoken about with too much emphasis on the intelligence side of things and less emphasis on the other qualities such as musicality, such as artistic ability, such as athletic ability. And really what we need to be doing is talking about improving the artistic ability on average of the nation, improving the creative abilities of the nation on average, as well as increasing the intelligence. And I think if we start to use more thoughtful, softer wording in terms of describing what needs to be done as far as the introduction of eugenics program is concerned, then we will have far greater success. And I think talking about excluding people who've got less desirable characteristics from breeding, then that again is taking the wrong step, because what we want is for the people who have less desirable characteristics to feel that eugenics is actually going to be beneficial to them. And the point is, if you are somebody that's got some kind of congenital condition, which means that you've got a less desirable characteristics than the population generally, if somebody's talking about stopping you from having children, in some cases during the in certain parts of the world, it wasn't generalized throughout the whole world, but in certain parts around the world, people did talk about sterilizing people who had less desirable characteristics. So, you know, there has been a real fear on the part of people who've got less desirable characteristics they've become emotionally opposed to eugenics, and they're so emotionally opposed to eugenics they're reluctant to logically think it through, and they don't actually appreciate the logic of eugenics, because the emotional hit that they take is so severe. And so if we talk about limiting the family size of people who've got less desirable characteristics so that they reproduce at a rate which is just slightly below the reproduction rate needed to maintain numbers, and encouraging people who've got more attractive and more desirable characteristics to have to reproduce at a rate which is slightly ahead of the purely reproduction rate, or replacement rate, I should say, that's the term I'm struggling for there, slightly ahead of the replacement rate, then what you would have is generation by generation, there would be an improvement in the qualities exhibited by your nation. And the point is, that would then be beneficial for people who've got less desirable characteristics, because those people would still be able to have children. They would still have a posterity, and their posterity could still benefit, because what would happen is that in the next generation, their children would have a richer gene pool from which to choose a mate. And as each successive generation would go by, that the people with the less desirable characteristics, their descendants would have a richer and a richer gene pool. And so because they would have, there would be this richer and richer gene pool, it would mean that their descendants would benefit from having this pool of people to choose from to find a mate that were of higher genetic quality, because it would then lift their genetic quality, and over a period of generations those people with the less desirable characteristics would lose those less desirable characteristics, or their children, their future generations would lose those less desirable characteristics and would gain the desirable characteristics. And so if you have if you approach eugenics on that kind of a basis, there can be no reason for people with less desirable characteristics to have this emotional block as far as looking at the logic of eugenics.
I think I also have to point out that when we're talking about the nation there, mm-hmm. we're talking about the original definition of the nation. All people are the same ethnicity. Because otherwise you could say, if you're talking like a multicultural country, and you're saying, well, you're going to, the less desirable people aren't going to breed, then you can say, well, the less desirable people with a lower IQ, and then you can say, well, you've got certain races that have got lower IQ, you've got certain races that have got a higher IQ. So we're not talking about removing people from other races, because we're starting with a nation that is a nation in the first place, which is ethnically homogenous. And then you get the people that are undesirable, or the people with undesirable traits not breeding, and the people with desirable traits breeding. And then that would be good for all the different nations of the world, whether they're black, Chinese, Jewish, white. I mean, it would benefit all of them to have the more desirable traits increased, so that the nation as a whole ends up having a better character and being more competent in fulfilling its needs and whatever it wants to do. The concept itself, eugenics, predates the term. Plato suggested applying the principles of selective breeding to humans around 400 BC. Early advocates of eugenics in the 19th century regarded it as a way of improving groups of people. In contemporary usage, the term eugenics is closely associated with so-called scientific racism. And modern bioethicists who advocate new eugenics characterize it as a way of enhancing individual traits, regardless of group membership. And yeah, it would increase individual traits, but those individuals are always going to be a member of a certain group. So if you were just to be enhancing the individual traits of members of one group, then obviously they're going to advance fast above the other groups. I mean, what you could do there, I mean, you could look at Jews, and Jews have a very high IQ, and that is because of basically a eugenics policy amongst the Jews, which selected for people that were very good at reading the Talmud. So they selected scholars, and if your daughter married a scholar or a Talmud scholar, that was seen as a very good thing. So the Jews themselves, they elevated Talmudism, intellectualism to a high degree. So people married people because they were Talmudic scholars, and that has resulted in the Jews having a higher IQ. And you could take another group, you could say perhaps with Europeans, we raised up the warrior archetype more so than the intellectual archetype. So we would have a slightly lower IQ, but we would have a better physique, better athleticism. And again, you don't very rarely that you see Jews that are extremely athletic, say in the Olympic Games. You don't see Israel doing particularly well, but you do see them having this high IQ. So you do get a certain amount of eugenics which happens naturally. And I also think I mean, it's basically just farming, isn't it? It's animal husbandry. If you're a farmer, you're always going to breed your best bull with your cows. You're always going to breed your best ram with your cows. And certain bulls and certain rams go for huge amounts of money, purely because they're the very best example of their breed. It's exactly the same with pedigrees, with dogs. You know, that's why you have the pedigree, to make certain that the dog is not a mongrel, to make certain that it is a pedigree, that it's going to have these characteristics and the temperament that you're actually wanting. And this is something that's always gone on with animals. It's called animal husbandry. And yet when it's applied to humans, we say, oh, well, this is a terrible thing. We can't possibly do this with humans, calling it scientific racism when it's involved with humans. We do it with plants as well. We crossbreed the best plants against each other to get the very best plant that we can get. I mean, what is so wrong with trying to get the very best Chinaman, the very best Jew, the very best Englishman, you know, the very best example of their people, and to continually improve the quality of those people? You know, if we'd been doing this for centuries, we probably wouldn't have any diseases now, because we would have encouraged the people to breed that had the greatest resistance to disease. Maybe we wouldn't have people that were short-sighted anymore, but we wouldn't have people that need glasses or contact lenses, because we would have encouraged the breeding of people that had perfect eyesight. And this is something that really we should have been doing for centuries. I'm amazed that they didn't really give a name to it until the 19th century. But as it says here, you know, Plato was talking about this in 400 BC. Any thoughts on that, Max?
Yeah, there is a danger, though, in talking about animal husbandry in connection with human eugenics. The point is that I quite often point out to people that are interested in dogs and dog breeds. Very often people will mention that a particular dog of a particular breed is just like all the other dogs of the same breed, looks so similar that unless you actually live with a dog and it's your pet and you see it every day, it's very difficult for you to tell the difference between a dog of one breed and another dog of the same breed, because they just look so similar. And the point there is that in order to fix the genetic characteristics so that you can create a breed of dogs, very often it's necessary for you to cross-breed fathers with daughters and cousins with cousins and brothers and sisters together, to such a point that there is the danger of there being some kind of genetic disease that could occur as a result of a lack of diversity within a particular breed. Now, as far as breeding dogs are concerned, if you're breeding dogs and you're producing a dog which matches which matches the breed standard, it is a problem if later on in their life that particular breed of dog starts to develop hip dysplasia and that could be the result of too closely breeding of dogs. It would be a greater problem from the point of view of humans, because you can't, you're not going to feel inclined to just go and put down somebody who's developed hip dysplasia in the way that you might take a dog to the vet and have it put down because it's in so much pain as a result of its hip dysplasia. And so the breeding of domestic animals isn't quite the same as eugenics. Eugenics does require there to be for it to be done successfully over successive generations, it is necessary for there to be sufficient diversity so that there will be different characteristics within the within the gene pool, within the nation, where the degree of breeding restriction is nowhere near as tight as it would be if you're trying to create a breed of dog or a breed of cow or something like that. You know, people are quite happy to crossbreed animals to the point where it starts to cause genetic problems. But you wouldn't want to do that in the case of humans, because you would then you could then have a situation where you have large numbers of people that have got genetic diseases as a result of them being too closely crossbred. If you can maintain a degree of diversity within a nation, so that the nation would be made up of people who are broadly similar but who have slightly different characteristics, then that's fine. They still identify as a nation. Some people, if you look at a typical European country, some people with blue eyes, some people with green eyes, some people with brown eyes, some people with brown hair, some people with blonde hair, some people with dark hair, and some people that are slightly taller, some people that are slightly shorter, some people that are slightly heavier built, some people that are slightly less built. You can encompass all of that within a nation. You don't have to narrow the breeding down to the point where every single human looks like a clone of the other, which is what you do when you're breeding domestic animals.
Yeah, I suppose when you're breeding animals, you're looking for this uniformity in how they look. Whereas with human beings, obviously you don't want people all to look the same, and you've also got a certain amount of hybrid vigor where you have two obviously. Part of the two people that are part of the same race, but are just different enough so that you get this hybrid vigor, because you obviously you're going to want it from within one group, so you want to keep the diversity there. I think what you're talking about there is, Max, is they're more prone to disease, aren't they? If you're breeding too close together, then you can become more prone to disease and weakness, which defeats the object, isn't it? So I guess when you're breeding dogs, you're not breeding them for strengths, and you're actually breeding them for how they look. Whereas if you were to be engaged in eugenics, we want people to have a lot of disease resistance. You would want them to be athletic. You'd also want them to be intelligent. You'd be trying to breed in all these different traits to get the very best traits of, say, if you were just use Europeans, for example, all the best traits that Europeans have. You'd be trying to breed them into it rather than just how they look.
If you tried to breed humans in the same way that you would breed domestic animals, then what could happen is that where within the breeding stock that you've got, there is perhaps an unhelpful gene mutation. Just having that one gene mutation may not cause a problem, whereas if you continually crossbreed the animals ignorant of that mutation, then what you'll have is the mutation will occur in more individuals within your breeding stock, and so therefore you'll have people who've got a double dose of that bad mutation, or a treble dose of that bad mutation, to the point where it starts to produce a disease such as hip dysplasia that you get with dogs. And of course that's crossbreeding to the point where it's unhelpful. There are certain ethnic groups in the UK at the moment within the Asian community where it's quite common for cousins to marry cousins repetitively. And again, in that situation, you do get deformities occurring where very often these deformities are mental deformities where the person has got some kind of mental deficiency as a result of the slow accumulation over generations of a harmful mutation, which on its own doesn't actually create a problem, but if that mutation is too concentrated within the breeding stock, then it can produce a harmful mutation, and that's why a eugenics program for a nation has to be one which is conscious of the need for there to be a degree of diversity within the nation, so that you don't create this concentration of harmful mutations, and so that it doesn't produce genetic diseases.
Yeah, that's a good example of a dysgenic breeding practice, isn't it? Marrying your cousins, and then the result that has. I think it's a third cousin three times removed is the optimum. So cousin three times removed. Obviously that's somebody that is fairly like you. I mean, that's pretty much what a nation should be anyway, is like cousins three times removed, because you're all united together by your ancestry. Well, while eugenics principles have been practiced as early as ancient Greece, the contemporary history of eugenics began in the late 19th century, when a popular eugenics movement emerged in the United Kingdom and then spread to many countries, including the United States, Canada, Australia, and most European countries. So it was something that actually began in the United Kingdom. It began with Sir Francis Galton taking interest in what Charles Darwin was doing, who was actually his cousin. Again, we've talked about this before, the way that intelligence goes down in families. You end up with very intelligent families, parents and children. It's the same with musicians. You know, if you're a musician or not is passed down through inheritance. And in this period, people from across the political spectrum espoused eugenic ideas. So this wasn't a right-wing idea, it wasn't a left-wing idea. It was just an idea that why would anybody not want to improve the stock of the nation? Consequently, many countries adopted eugenic policies intended to improve the quality of their population's genetic stock. Such programs included both positive measures, such as encouraging individuals deemed particularly fit to reproduce, and negative measures such as marriage prohibitions and forced sterilization of people deemed unfit for reproduction. I do think there wasn't any forced sterilization in Britain. I may be proved wrong as we go through this series. We'll have to see. Those deemed unfit to reproduce often included people with mental or physical disabilities, people who scored in the low ranges on different IQ tests, criminals, and deviants and members of disfavored minority groups. And of course, they say disfavored minority groups there, but if you're part of a minority group, you're not part of the ethnic nation anyway. So if you're a minority group, you would be doing the same thing. You would be picking the people with the desirable characteristics to breed with, and people with undesirable characteristics, encouraging them not to breed. So the fact that they include this members of disfavored minority groups shows that they're already going against what the idea should actually be. And surely it's just sensible to encourage people that have mental or physical disabilities not to force that curse onto their next generation, not to produce other children or other people that are going to have mental or physical disabilities. And it's the same with low range on IQ tests. I mean, if you got under 70 IQ and you're European, I forget what the term is, it might be borderline retarded, something like that. So again, it's like, why would you want to increase people with this low IQ? Obviously, criminality runs in families, and that's been shown by statistics many times. So why would you want them to reproduce and produce another generation that are going to end up in prison, that are going to end up being a burden on the rest of the nation? So these are the reasons why these ideas took hold, because they were sensible ideas. Max, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that that the logic behind eugenics is absolutely bulletproof. It's what I said earlier on, though. It's where the terminology that was used by advocates of eugenics in the past was not as appealing as it might otherwise have been, where they, as I said earlier, talked about inferior and superior individuals. And as I say, if you are somebody who fears that they might be regarded as being of inferior stock, and you fear that you might be stopped from being able to have children, then you're going to oppose eugenics, and you're going to be the sort of person who can very easily be panicked into opposing eugenics per se from an emotional perspective, by somebody who is a malicious opponent of eugenics. And so what we need to do is to make sure that when we talk about eugenics, we always use terminology which shows that we hold a sympathetic view, and that we hold a progressive view with regard to eugenics. It's not a matter of stopping people from having children. It's a matter of generation by generation decreasing the number of people who exhibit the less desirable characteristics, and generation by generation increasing the number of people who exhibit the more attractive characteristics. So for example, if you were a father and you had a child, and your child just couldn't play a musical instrument, their degree of musicality was zero, for example, and you then had the choice of your child being able to choose a mate from amongst a group of people who similarly have little or no musical ability, or them being able to choose from a group where every single member of that group has a high level of musicality and can play musical instruments very, very easily. What would you want from the point of view of if you were a fan of good music? What would you want? Well, obviously you'd want your child to be able to choose a mate from amongst the population that's got a high degree of musicality. You wouldn't want them to only be able to choose a mate from amongst a group that's got no musicality, because that would then mean that the lack of musicality would progress, would go forward into successive future generations, and that would be a sad thing, because those future generations would not have that appreciation of music. Whereas if because of a eugenic program, it meant that the number of people that your child can choose from included people with high levels of musicality, then it could mean that in future generations you would have children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren who would have a high level of musical ability and who would therefore benefit from that.
We should always strive to be as objective as we possibly can, particularly when talking about sensitive subjects, I think, and particularly when talking about our competitors as well. We should always try to be as objective as possible. Thank you very much for listening, and watch out for part two of British Eugenics here at RadioAlbion.com.